Ursula Jones is nothing short of a musical icon, according to the Royal Philharmonic Society, who made her an honorary member last year at the age of 92. She's devoted her life to music and has long championed the work of young performers. She gave Daniel Barenboim his first break as a conductor in London when he was just 23. Ursula was born in Lucerne in 1932, where her father was one of the founders of the Lucerne Festival. So famous musicians, including the likes of Richard Strauss, were never far away. She came to London in 1954 and worked as a secretary for the Philharmonia Orchestra, moving on to co-found the English Chamber Orchestra in 1960. She married the eminent trumpet player Philip Jones and later managed his brass ensemble. Music isn't her only fascination. She completed a doctorate in archaeology at the age of 60, and in 2021 she cycled 100 kilometres to raise money for the charity Brass for Africa. You have come into contact with so many great musicians, so many great pieces of music, and today, for example, we've got Britten, Mozart, Handel. But I think we're going to start, Ursula, with Honegger.
Yes, that would be very nice. It's a long time ago.
When did you encounter this then?
Well, I think I was in my fourth or fifth primary school year, and we had a teacher who was a singer, and she organized that our class could go to Zurich and take part in Honecker's King David, which was, of course, very exciting for us. And that was the only time I was on stage, I think.
He was probably the most famous Swiss composer, wasn't he?
Yes, I knew him later on, but then he lived in Paris and he was regarded as a French composer, but he was definitely Swiss.
A nice man, did you like him?
Yes, he was very nice. I remember meeting him at a party at a friend of my parents, and it was in a garden, and for fun they did shooting, and he was very good at it. And then we went swimming together, and he was a bit round, and he was very jolly but quiet person.
Yeah. Yeah. He had buoyancy then when he was swimming.
Yes.
Well, here we are. Let's hear the final part of the Dance Before the Ark from King David by Honegger.
Thank you.
bring back memories?
Yes, it was at the time very exciting for us young children, really, to go and sing on the stage in the Turnhalle in Zurich.
The final part of the dance, Before the Ark, from King David by Honegger, performed by the Lausanne Vocal Ensemble and the Swiss Roman Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Royes. Ursula, let's hear a little bit more about your early life in Lucerne in Switzerland. That's got a wonderful old part of the town, 14th century.
Yes, it's a lovely town. I didn't realize that so much when I was a child, but much later on, with the lake and the mountains behind. And then, of course, the music. When I was six, I think, 1938, the Lucerne Festival was founded. My father was one of the founder members. And so from early time onwards, we always had musicians in our house. And I didn't appreciate it so much at that time. But much later on, of course, I thought how lucky I was really to be brought up like that.
Were both your parents musical?
No, my mother was very much more into pictures and into visual arts. And one of my uncles, he became quite a famous painter. And he has his own museum now in Lucerne. Hans Erni, his name was. And through him, I used to meet other artists. And I remember I was always a great fan of Picasso. When I was a teenager, I thought, you know, I would really like to be Picasso's wife. And I was, through my uncle, I was invited to a vernissage, an opening of an exhibition by Georges Braque. There were an awful lot of people there. And suddenly I felt something very strong on me. And I looked up and it was Picasso's bull eyes, these huge brown eyes. And I was so shocked that I just disappeared. But that was my only chance, really.
But I think you did meet Marc Chagall, because he used to visit your parents.
Yes, he came to our house as well. And Kokoschka, of course. Mm. I have actually a little picture in my house. Self-portrait of Kokoschka. He liked my mother very much. And it says underneath, Dear Frau Maria, isn't that a good-looking man? But she did take part in music, and musicians always liked her very much. She was a very smart and elegant lady, and I was recently looking through our old guest books, and there were always compliments to my mother.
And would there be musicians that visited who played in the house?
Yes, we had a lot of house concerts. For instance, Clara Haskell played, with Carl Flesch. We had the quartet from our local orchestra, you know, the Lucerne Symphony Orchestra, LSO, Lucerne Symphony Orchestra.
The other one, the other LSO.
The other one, yes, yes. And we used to have the principals who played quartets. Yes.
Did you have a favourite musician who came, who you really took
well,
to?
Well, I liked Edwin Fischer very well, yes. He was marvellous. Mm. And my mother, she always saw a better house or a better flat. And so we moved quite often. And Edwin Fischer always wanted to be the last guest in old flat and the first guest in the new one. And he even wrote poems.
There are people who feel that Fischer was one of the really greatest interpreters of his time.
Yes, I mean, he was the first one that I knew who actually directed from the piano.
And did Richard Strauss ever come?
Yes, you know, sometimes these artists came and had lunch in our house or dinner, and I had to help a little bit. And one day, you know, Mother said Strauss was coming, very famous composer, and I naturally thought it was the Waltz King, Johann Strauss.
Yes.
And I was very disappointed when somebody came whose name was Richard Strauss.
Although from a musical point of view, in a sense, that's an even greater honour.
Yes, he was already quite an old man, and he looked to me a little bit like a farmer, really, I remember. Much later on, of course, I became a great lover of Strauss, of all his works.
Another piece now to remind you of Switzerland. I think it's the White Horse Inn.
Yes. Well, I was allowed to go to the theatre from time to time when I was a child, and I always remember the Benatsky, Im Weißen Rössel, Wolfgangsee. I used to think that was absolutely marvellous.
Im Weißen Rössel am Wolfgangsee, da steht das Glück vor der Tür. und ruft dir zu, guten Morgen, tritt ein und vergiss deine Sorgen. Und musst du dann einmal fort von hier, tut dir der Abschied so weh. Dein Herz, das hast du verloren im weißen Rössel am See. Pisa hat den schiefen Turm als Attraktion, Paris den Eiffelturm, der steht noch grad. Washington hat's weiße Haus, was ist das schon? Denn ohne weißes Ross ist es doch fad. In the White Horse Guest House am Wolfgang Lake stands happiness at the door. Bonjour, Madame, ciao, Bambina. Und schönen guten Morgen, ja, Berliner. Und musst du dann einmal fort von hier, tut dir der Abschied so weh. Dein Herz, das hast du verloren im weißen Rössel am
It's very amusing, and you were conducting it there, Ursula.
Well, that's a very much more modern version than I heard when I was a child.
The White Horse Inn by Ralph Bernatsky, sung by Peter Alexander. Now, did you learn a musical instrument, Ursula
yes,
Jones?
Yes, I started the piano when I was about 7 or so. And, of course, I played the recorder at school. And I also did a little bit on the violin, but that was quite hard, and I gave that up.
And did you play with your father?
Yes, he played the violin, and always on a Sunday morning, we would have 2-3 hours together. And my mother used to be quite upset because she worked quite hard. She always worked together with my father. And so Sunday morning was for her rest. And so then we played all sorts of things like operatic excerpts and enjoyed ourselves. And it kept her awake, of course. Poor Mama couldn't sleep anymore.
How had your father earned his living? Was he a businessman or what?
He was a lawyer, and that's how I knew quite a lot of musicians, because he helped, for instance, Furtwängler to stay in Switzerland. He stayed with us occasionally, and I remember in our very old flat, I used to have to give him my bed and sleep on a deck chair for a night or two. And I also remember that we used to have supper before he had his concert. He liked food and drink, but suddenly he became very quiet and everybody would talk around, and he obviously just concentrated on his program. This concentration impressed me very much at that time, that somebody could just switch off completely from the surroundings and sit at the table and think about what he's doing later on.
And it is Furtwängler who's going to be conducting the Beethoven 9. Which movement have you chosen?
Well, I like the scherzo.
Then his scherzo you shall have.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. I just think, you know, this music is so extraordinary. Of a composer who was deaf at the time, could hear all these sounds, marvellous. But I also remember, of course, the last movement of Beethoven 9, the choral movement. Furtwängler complained to my father that the choir, which was our local Lucerne choir, all the old ladies were in the front row and the nice young ladies in the back.
Actually, I was just thinking that that scherzo has so much fun in it, doesn't it? And did Furtwängler react to fun and comedy?
He certainly did. And he could be quite witty as well. And of course, very charming.
We heard the scherzo from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, performed at the Lucerne Festival in 1954 by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Wilhelm Furtwängler. And you saw him conducting that piece there, didn't you?
Yes, and that was actually the moment when I had just done my translator in the University of Geneva in German, French and Italian, and I thought I better do English as well. And I asked the director of the Philharmonia, Walter Legg, whether I could come to England and work in their office for 6 months or so. And he said, yes, fine. So later that year, 1954, the Philharmonia came again to Switzerland with Karajan conducting. And they didn't play in Lucerne, but they played in Zurich. And after Zurich, they played in Milano at La Scala. I met them in a place where the trains from Zurich and Lucerne linked up. The orchestra was there. I didn't really know anybody. So we arrived at La Scala, and because I was my father's daughter, I got a ticket to the concert. And when I went to my seat, it was in a box with Toscanini and Celibidache. But I was a young, very shy girl, you know, I just sat there very quietly.
You became a secretary for the Philharmonia Orchestra.
Yes, and I remember they offered me £4 a week.
How did you come to meet Philip Jones?
Yeah, that was quite extraordinary. In 55, in the summer, we had Guido Cantelli conducting two performances of the Verdi Requiem. That was sort of the highlight of the programme. And I had to get 10 trumpets, and we only had 3 trumpets in the orchestra. So my boss gave me a list, and there was Philip Jones, and I rang him, and he said he had something else, but he would try and make himself free. And he rang me the next day, and he said, I'm terribly sorry, I can't do this, because I have an important cricket match. And for me, cricket was croquet. I didn't know the difference between cricket and croquet. And I thought, this must be a very strange fellow to turn down 2 Verdi Requiems to play croquet on the grass. Anyway, but I did engage Philip again sometime, and then he engaged me, and that was that.
Well, how did your parents feel about your going out with him?
They were absolutely shocked. An Englishman, and on top of that, a trumpet player. Just imagine. They asked me immediately to come home.
And, of course, brass players don't have a very good reputation. Philip was one of the most urbane and charming and well-behaved people. He was always very finely chiselled.
He was tall but very thin, and I always remembered, because when we first met, he was only about 55 kilos and I was more than that. And I tried to get at least to his weight, and somebody said, don't eat anything solid before lunchtime, which I've done for 60, 70 years now.
You lived together, didn't you, first, which is rather unusual in those days. You must have had to fool your parents.
That was absolutely terrible, you know. One of my violinists in the Philharmonia Orchestra, Jesse Hinchley, offered me an alibi address. And whenever my parents came, I moved quickly into my alibi address.
Very naughty.
And then we decided to get married. Father didn't come, but mother did come. That was in 1956, on the 1st of August, which is Swiss National Day. I thought then I would never forget.
Apart from his expertise on the trumpet, Philip also loved the Alphorn, didn't he?
Yes, and I remember we were on a skiing holiday quite early in our marriage, and we went to a mountain restaurant, and there was an Alphorn player. And Philip said, oh, you know, I'd love to try. And so I went to ask this chap, I didn't say he was a professional trumpet player, whether he could have a little blow, and the restaurant was absolutely full. And so Philip went on this Alphorn, and played, of course, much better than the Alpen. He was furious, that Alpen player, and so we went out as quickly as possible. And when we built our little chalet in the mountains in Switzerland, he said, I must have an Alphorn. And then I had a little Schweizerörgeli. That's this very small accordion. Mm. And we played duos on it. You know. And then he acquired several Alphorns, actually. Also a Büchel, which is a wound round. It looks a little bit like a trombone, you know, but also wood. He loved playing it. And he used to have to play in the mountains. I wouldn't make dinner before he'd played something really nice. But with that smaller instrument, he was very often invited by the shepherds in our mountain area. When they had feasts, he would go and play there for them.
Wonderful. Philip went on to found the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble, which really completely changed the repertoire for brass instruments in this country. And funnily enough, I don't know whether any of our more eagle-eared listeners noticed that we used a slightly different version of the music from Chaucer, which begins the programme, which I wrote for Philip and Radio 3 many years ago, because he played on that recording. He was the first person to play it.
Yes, I remember that very well. That was quite exciting for him, yes, yeah, to do that. Well, when I knew him first, the ensemble existed, but it played perhaps two or three times a year and mostly with choirs or with somebody else. And wherever we went abroad with the English Chamber Orchestra, I always said to the organisers that my husband had a brass ensemble. Chamber music on brass was just not really regarded very highly. Anyway, one day, one of the organisers in Switzerland rang me and said, you said your husband had a brass ensemble. How large is it? And I said, it's a quintet. And he said, could he come with more? And usually people said, could he come with less so that they could pay less? So that's when Philip thought of enlarging it to 10, four trumpets, four trombones, horn and tuba. And that really established sort of Philip Jones formation, which is used nowadays quite a lot.
And one of the pieces that emerged through the ensemble was a version of the Mussorgsky Pictures at an Exhibition. Mussorgsky was inspired by the idea of somebody going round an exhibition and looking at different pictures.
Oh, well, that was Georger Hauer. He arranged it for 16 brass players and two percussion. They recorded it for Decca, and Philip came home and said, you know, we won't be able to do that in public because it's so difficult. Within about a year or so, they started doing it at concerts. They even did it at the proms, abroad on festivals, and it became quite something. And I think the Times critic thought that it was better than Ravel's orchestration.
Well, that's
more interesting,
something.
Yes.
Well, it's rather wonderful that we can pay tribute to Elgar Howarth, who died very recently. Which movements would you like to listen to?
I think Samuel Goldberg and the duet of the two Jews is very interesting.
And Promenade 5, yeah. And the weekly
and
market.
And the Market of Limoges, of course, that is wonderful. I mean, that's marvellously sought out by Elgar Howarth, yeah, to picture it like that.
Thank you.
Absolutely wonderful writing for brass. Those three movements from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, played by the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble and conducted by the man who arranged them, the late Elgar Howarth. I think you were also involved in the first performance of West Side Story here in the UK.
Yes, it goes back really to when I fell in love with Philip, and the owner and director of the Philharmonia, Walter Lake, was also a friend of my parents, so he was against me and Philip as well. So anyway, Mr. Lake didn't make me orchestral manager, and so I left. I was sort of a bit of freelance, and one day a telephone call came from Lawrence Leonard, conductor of West Side Story, first time he came to Europe, and he said, would you like to put the orchestra together for the West Side Story? And I said, of course I would like to. And it was actually a scandal, because the West End orchestras was entirely the privilege and the monopoly of fiddle players. And there came a girl and a foreigner. They tried to stop me. Anyway, I did it, and it was such a good orchestra that other impresarios asked me. And at one stage in the early 60s, I had about five West End orchestras in the theatres, and I used to go on a Friday, you know, to get some money from the impresarios and then put it into little envelopes and go and pay out.
How did your life with the English Chamber Orchestra begin, Ursula Jones? Because the English Chamber Orchestra didn't begin with that name, did it?
No. It was then the Arnold Goldsborough Orchestra, which had been founded by Arnold Goldsborough, the harpsichord player. There was a viola player called Quinton Ballardi. He rang me up one day and said, could you help me organise a tour with Walter Gurr, the conductor, to France, which I did, of course, with great pleasure. It went very well, and at the end of the tour, Quinton Ballardi said, could you manage this orchestra? I thought that was a lovely idea, and I tried to sell the orchestra of young players abroad. And nobody could pronounce that name, Goldsborough. I mean, B-R-O-U-G-H, that was just
that's very British, isn't it?
And so I said to Quinton Ballardi, look, we have to change the name.
And then Benjamin Britten sort of adopted the ECO
For the Old Festival, yes, that's right. And then, of course, we had some marvellous years. The orchestra did several premieres of his new works. One of the most marvellous things was Midsummer Night's Dream, the premiere, I shall never forget, in the Jubilee Hall.
What did you make of Benjamin Britten as a person?
I knew him a bit through Paul Sacher already, through Switzerland. Paul Sacher was my godfather, and so, in a way, it was very easy for me. I could directly talk to him about problems and so on, whereas normally people had to go via an entourage of people. I mean, I admired him enormously, and I liked him too, but he could be difficult.
Yeah.
I always remember one occasion when I used to give him the list of the orchestra, because our orchestra was freelance. Our bassoon had something else, and I engaged the principal bassoon of another orchestra. And Ben Britten rang me on the telephone. He said, if he plays, I'm not conducting. And that was about at 5 days' notice for a 2.5 week tour. Yeah. In desperation, I rang the professor at the Royal Academy of Music, Gwydion Brook. And Gwyd said, yes, he had a young chap. He was really very good. He came, and I remember the first rehearsal at one place. Benjamin Britten stopped conducting, and this bassoon player, in a very cockney voice, said, oh, Mr. Britten, I think you wrote that wrongly there in that particular part. And I thought, oh, my God, that's the end of him. Anyway, they became good friends. It was all right.
Well, I'm fascinated by your next choice of music representing Benjamin Britten.
The Cello Symphony. Well, that was, of course, very exciting. You know, Ben Britten got to know Mstislava Rostropovich. I think he wrote it for him.
He did.
Yes. Mm. And I remember a performance in the actual Guildhall. Mm. It was terrific. And we recorded it, of course, as well. And then Slava became a friend of the orchestra, and we went on tour with him. He directed from the cello.
Well, here is the movement you've chosen, the Passacaglia from the Britten Cello Symphony, performed by Rostropovich with the ECO, directed by Britten himself.
Thank you.
Passacaglia from Britten's Symphony for Cello and Orchestra, performed by Mstislav Rostropovich and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Britten. Wonderfully muscular sound there, wasn't it? Huge energy, which sort of summed up Rostropovich's character.
Yeah. I still see him there playing.
You're listening to Private Passions with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, Ursula Jones, one of the founders of the English Chamber Orchestra. When you first met Daniel Barenboim, Ursula, he was quite well known as a pianist, but I think you helped launch his career as a conductor. How did that come about?
Well, the orchestra was engaged to do a concert in Manchester with Daniel as soloist, and he remembered me from Lucerne, because he came to Lucerne as a boy to the masterclasses with Edwin Fischer, and he said, you know, I would like to not just play with your orchestra, but conduct as well. And I mentioned it to our leader, Manny Hurwitz, and to others. They weren't very keen. And then I liked the idea, actually, because I remember from Edwin Fischer, you know, how it worked from the piano. And I had to one day organize something at very short notice. In those days, John Lewis used to do concerts in their branches outside. And I had to arrange something in Cambridge and Reading. And so I thought, let's try out Barenboim. And I shall never forget, we had an extra rehearsal. And it was in Morley College. And it was a revelation. My orchestra and everybody realized that there was a genius, you know, and he could actually conduct. Anyway, that was the beginning of an interesting few years.
Well, remarkable.
It took time, actually, to persuade people.
And I think you organised the first official concert with him at Fairfield Halls in Croydon, where you asked the pianist Vladimir Ashkenazy to come and play the Mozart Double Concerto.
It was actually Ashkenazy who offered to do that, because I wanted to do a concert in a festival hall, but I couldn't get to a festival hall. In those days, only the Mozart players could play there once a month. And so I rented Fairfield Hall, because it was, funnily enough, it coincided with my birthday on the 11th of March, 1966. I remember very well. So Ashkenazy said, oh, I'll come and play the double with Daniel, because Ashkenazy was already quite well known here, whereas Daniel Barenboim wasn't. And so then Christopher Newpen, who was somebody who worked in the BBC television department, said he would try and see whether it could be recorded for television. We have a little story how it all came about, called Double Concerto.
It was an important step in filming music.
Yes.
And you were in it, weren't you?
Oh, yes, it became quite famous. Yeah, because it was on my birthday. I think Christopher Newpen said I should say a few words. Mm. And that was really the beginning of several years of wonderful partnership with Daniel.
What was the atmosphere like in the hall that night?
Well, that was very exciting, both from the orchestra's point of view and also from the public. It was a full house.
I think we should hear a movement, don't you, from...
That would be lovely, yes.
Yeah. So here's the rondo from the Double Concerto, played by Barenboim and Ashkenazy with the ECO. Thank you. Absolutely
fabulous.
It's wonderful, isn't it? And the fun that they're all having, clearly bouncing off each other.
Yeah.
There we heard Baron Boyb and Ashkenazi and the English Chamber Orchestra.
I still remember, you know, we went right round the world. And then, of course, Jackie Dupre came on. That was also quite extraordinary because Daniel had the beginnings of glandular fever and was very worried about it. And somebody said, speak to Jackie Dupre because she had it and she will tell you what to do about it. And he met Jackie, actually I was there as well, at a party, and that's where they met, because of glandular fever, I suppose. They talked to each other, and that was the beginning of this wonderful connection.
And what did you make of Jacqueline du Pre?
Oh, she was an absolutely wonderful person, very warm and very thoughtful, and of course a great artist. Mm. Fantastic. It was very sad when she went ill, but I do remember already on one of the trips, I think it was to Australia, she was very tired all the time, and I always thought that Daniel, you know, he was such a life wire, he tired her out, but I think it might have been already the beginning of her illness.
Next, Janet Baker. She sang a lot with the English Chamber Orchestra and with Raymond Leppard and people like that, didn't she?
Yes. I knew her very first in Bath, when she was not known at all. Mm. There was a lunchtime concert in the town hall, I think, with a young singer, and that was Janet.
A wonderful voice. Did you particularly want to hear her singing Purcell?
Yes, and I think that's such a beautiful tune, Died of Lament.
Oh,
When I Am Lady Nurse from Dido and Aeneas by Purcell, the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Anthony Lewis and Janet Baker singing. I think you're still good friends with Janet Baker.
Yes, I just saw her the other day in the Wigmore Hall. She still comes to concerts to listen to other people. And I think she's, to me, one of the greatest singers. A very, very personal, wonderful voice, quite unique.
Well, talking about the personal Ursula Jones, the next piece is by the fine Polish composer and conductor Witold Lutosławski, and I think that there's a personal connection with your family here.
My father asked me when I was 49, what would you like for your 50th birthday? And I said, it would be lovely to have a composition by Lutosławski for Philip's ensemble. So my father, of course, being Swiss, he said, how much? Anyway, it was arranged. Lutosławski said he was very pleased to do something. And then political trouble started in Poland and we didn't hear anything anymore. And Philip, by sheer chance, was offered a date in Lucerne either the day before or the day after my 50th birthday. And so we thought we would have the premiere there and also a party and so on. Anyway, we didn't hear any more. And then about 2 weeks before the date, a parcel arrived in a Swedish embassy addressed to Philip, and it was Lutosławski's piece. And it was only a very short piece called Mini Overture. But there it was, and Philip said, oh, yes, we must do it.
I think, sadly, your father didn't hear it, did
no,
he?
No, in May before he died, suddenly. And that's also quite a funny story, because in the Wikipedia it said that I died and I never heard it. And nowadays brass ensembles know this story and they often ask me to talk to the audiences and tell them this story and say, well, here I am, I'm still here.
Thank you.
Oh, they had great fun with that, didn't they?
Well, it's still, I think, one of the best modern pieces. And it's now played by lots of brass ensembles. Even from memory they played, which I'm very impressed, of course.
Lutosławski's Mini Overture, performed by the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble. In your 50s, Ursula Jones, you made a big departure from music and threw yourself into archaeology, studying at London University. Was this something you'd always been interested in?
Well, I was always interested in pre-Columbian archaeology of Central America, Mexico, Guatemala, and all that area. I did know somebody called Stavenhagen, a refugee from Germany, and he lived in Mexico, and he was one of the first collectors of pre-Columbian art. And when I was on tour with ECO to Latin America, I always went to visit him. And mid-70s, Benjamin Britten was dying. Daniel Barenboim had flown out into the world as a conductor, and my orchestra had become a bit old. And Philip said to me one day, "Why don't you go a year to London University?" And so I did my 3 years and then got the BA, and then I went on.
You completed a PhD?
I did.
With a focus on what?
I did my dissertation on metates. Metates are grinding stones where you grind maize on it, basalt, usually carved of basalt, quite small things, sort of like tables. But between Honduras and Panama, they carved their grinding stones in very large pieces with wonderful details, jaguar heads, bird heads, and so on. And I found these objects first in the British Museum in their cellars, you know. And funnily enough, I met Henry Moore there, who was studying that. That was quite interesting. But they were all listed in the books as ceremonial tables or thrones. And I looked at them carefully, and I found that they had grinding marks and that they were actually used for grinding. And that became, it sounds a bit prosaic, you know, for a dissertation, but that's what it was.
Fascinating. What was Henry Moore doing?
Henry Moore was studying pre-Columbian art. He was very fascinated by things from Mexico and so on, sculptures and pottery and so on.
Yeah. You can see that in his work.
Yes.
You're still involved in championing Philip's work, and you sponsor a trumpet place on the National Youth Orchestra. Has that kept you pretty busy and sort of interested in the world of music?
Yes, I just can't give it up, really. I mean, and my mission really is to help young brass players. And I have now every 3 years an international competition for brass quintets. I also have every 2 years a concert in St. John's Smith Square with the best brass ensembles of 8 major colleges in England, Wales and Scotland. My most recent thing is a tuba player who won the gold medal in Trinity Laban last year against all the string players, pianists, singers and so on, called Louis Chin. Interestingly, very soon after he won the gold medal, I met the great-grandson of Sibelius in Glyndebourne, who is called Lauri Porra. And he's a jazz double bass player, actually. But he also composes, and in conversation it came out that he had composed a tuba concerto. So I mentioned this to Trinity, and it was actually premiered in December, just before Christmas.
Well, we can hear.
And Lauri Porra came.
Well, we have an excerpt from the UK premiere of the tuba concerto, so let's hear it.
Thank you.
An excerpt from the UK premiere of the Tuba Concerto by Lauri Pora, performed by Lewis Chin with Trinity Laban Symphonic Strings at Blackheath Halls in December last year, conducted by Alan Dugood. Ursula, you're never one for sitting still. In 2021, you cycled 100 kilometres to raise money for Brass for Africa. Why are you so passionate about the work that they do that you were prepared to take to your bicycle?
You know, my life is really, in memory of Philip, is Brass, helping Brass. And I did this fundraising specifically to help women brass players. Brass for Africa doesn't only teach them, but they also teach them to read and write and so on, because many have never been to school. And we have over 1,000 young players every year starting playing in Uganda, Rwanda and Liberia. And I had a group of them about 2 or 3 years ago in Switzerland, and they even learned to play the alp horn.
And until quite recently, you used to go paragliding.
Yes. I am afraid I've just cancelled it for the first time on my birthday now, because I think I'm really getting too old. Yes.
I'm not sure that you're ever too old to do anything. We're going to end with another great tuba player, John Fletcher, who played with your husband, Philip Jones. What have you chosen?
Oh, well, I just have to say about John Fletcher, he was really the first tuba player to make the instrument a musical instrument. Before, it was just an umpa instrument. I mean, he was absolutely fantastic. And one day, on one of the tours, I was sitting next to Elgar Howes on the aeroplane. Elgar didn't really like flying, and to sort of just make a little bit of entertainment, I started singing him Swiss tunes. And he liked them and wrote them down and then arranged them for the brass ensemble, quite a few of them. And there is one particular one which is called the Cuckoo. It has got the cuckoo which Fletcher, the tuba player, played through his hands, you know, the cuckoo. He even at one stage, I remember, I think it was in Richmond concert, where he climbed on a tree and the cuckoo came from the tree. And what is even more marvelous is that Elgar Howes, who was dying, and I went to visit him with his son, I thought, I'll take this record with me and play the cuckoo. And he actually opened his eyes and smiled a little bit. And his son says that's the last time he opened his eyes and smiled. So that was on the cuckoo.
Well, that's a wonderful note to finish on. Ursula Jones, thank you very much indeed as we hear The Cuckoo, written by Elgar Howes and performed by John Fletcher and Philip Jones.
Don't mention it. It was a great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. The Cuckoo, written by Elgar Howarth and performed by John Fletcher and Philip Jones. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the co-founder of the English Chamber Orchestra and philanthropist Ursula Jones. And the programme was produced by Claire Walker.